The following sermon audio is from Missio Dei Church, Cincinnati. More information about Missio Dei Church and our pursuit to be a gospel-centered, city-focused church community can be found at www.mdcincy.org.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Does anybody have any questions from the first half? So that was... Yeah, that was the really dense theological stuff, so hopefully it'll be a little quicker this time around. Yeah, what's up?
My wife and I were talking a little bit about it, and I did remember that there was a story, and somebody will maybe remember this, but in the Old Testament, where there was a guy, and there was two people having the act of sex in a tent, and he stabbed them. Happening, and it was accounted as
right,
I forget the name of or where it's found.
Was that Justin? Was that one of the? Phineas, was that one of the? No, that was a priest. It was one of the priests. Yeah. That's.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's I would. Again, so if we can go back to the distinction that in some ways it's not improper to think of Israel as a theonomy. So the high priest could kill some fornicators and it wouldn't necessarily be an unjust act. I would want to think some more about that. Correct. There's a range of interpretational possibilities with understanding kind of the political structure of the nation of Israel, and it is clear that it does vary from Abraham, all the way through the prophets. But it would not be improper to think of the nation of Israel as a theonomy, but that option is not open to us as Christians, just flat out.
Yeah, you see even in the New Testament Gospels with the woman who was caught in the act of adultery, though they were under Roman rule and under Caesar as a political identity, they were able to exercise stoning that girl, though they didn't because of Christ's involvement,
right.
But they would have been able to kill her and exercise that.
Right, they're right. Yeah, so the... Pharisees and Sadducees, so even up until the time of Christ, Israelites still operated with, we'll call it, a theonomous mindset. So even when they were no longer ruling themselves politically, the religious rulers still had a sense that they could enact physical coercive justice, and they felt justified or righteous doing that. So that's something to keep in mind.
Do you have places like that in the Middle East now with Sharia law, but under a democratic?
So you could look at, say, Turkey or Indonesia, which are largely democratic-ish political governments, but largely Muslim. And so, yeah, there's a lot of tensions in those particular countries because Muslims don't really have a conception. I mean, Muslims are theonomous just by design because to them, Allah is unitary, one God. Like, there isn't a whole lot of conceptual space in classical Islam. I mean, there are newer interpretations which make some room for a separation between church and state. So, all right, so we're going to blow through all of church history in, I hope, about 5 minutes. So if you thought I was doing the Old and New Testament fast and loose. Again, this pains me deeply as a pseudo-historian. So essentially I want to separate into three kind of phases of church history. So we have the apostles to Constantine, who lived who died in 337. So this is roughly the first, say, 200 years of the church's life. We have more or less continual persecution with very little real political power. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Can everybody hear? Was everyone able to hear me in the first half? Okay, with the AC, I should elocute a little more clearly, loudly. Is this good? Is this an appropriate tone?
Maybe louder.
Louder? Okay. I can go louder. Okay. And then Constantine didn't technically make, as Kurt was saying, Christianity the official religion, but for all intents and purposes, most of a large minority of the Roman Empire was Christian, and so over subsequent emperors, it became the official religion of the Roman Empire until it collapsed. In roughly the 500s.
Did you get your record again?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to double check. We want to keep all this goodness for posterity. Yeah, we're good to go. All right. And so once it's the official religion, clearly there's increasing political power. I would say it, not yet theonomy. So what we get... Probably, so what we get is, from Constantine on, there's increasing political power, Christianity, particularly in the person of the Pope in the Western world, has increasing political juice, we'll say. At first, emperors and then kings were more powerful than the popes. This is just a fact. Around 1075, a gentleman called Gregory the Great was declared pope. And he, based on some pretty interesting theological arguments, essentially fused the church and the state. So he argued that because the pope is the representative of God's authority on earth, that any true political authority must be authorized by the Pope. So it's a nifty trick there. Yeah. So essentially from that point until about the Reformation, the only legitimate political power was authorized by the church. So if the Pope didn't crown you king, you weren't king. That's kind of how that worked. Essentially married the church and the state, so the state punish those who are deemed to have incorrect doctrine. So this, is when we get, say, the institution of the Inquisition, the formal organ of the Roman Church, which actually punished, under the authority of the state, people who were deemed to be out of step with Roman Orthodoxy. Any questions on Christendom right now? All right. Reformation, we'll say 1517, when Martin Luther got to work, so we can celebrate that next year. Onward, there's a growing recognition that any attempt to apply God's new covenant rule to any part of creation that has not been made new in the spirit to be theologically incorrect and potentially tyrannical. So Christendom's not such a great idea. So with the early reformers, there was still sort of a sense in which, because they didn't have a conception of a non-Christian state. I mean, everyone was still, so in Geneva, where Calvin was, everyone was essentially Christian. So, I mean, there was, so even though they had increasingly theological and philosophical distinctions between the church and the state, they still functioned pretty closely. But here's where we start getting a divergence in both Protestant theology and Western philosophy. So what we get from the Reformation we can still hold on to today is there is no space for utopianism of any kind. Any system that claims to bring earth to heaven or heaven to earth does not accord with salvation realities. Does the term utopianism, does everybody know what I'm talking about? So a utopia is a perfect earthly society. So utopianism is, from a theological perspective, the attempt to bring the kingdom of God, the future realized kingdom of God, and realize it now. and that's just not open to us. And the Reformation is the beginning of the separation of church and state as we have it today. We will talk some more about that. I know that's a loaded term. So real quick, we have kind of today, throughout as church history progresses, we have roughly four models of church, how church and state, church and politics interact. We have antagonistic, which is the Anabaptist tradition. The Anabaptists were, they were sort of the radical arm of the Reformation. They essentially said that Christians should have no involvement with government or with the state. The state is only evil all the time.
Kind of like
the Tea Party. They just hate sub-governments. So contemporary Anabaptists would be, say, the Amish, Mennonites, and there are a number of theologians who kind of hold this perspective that Christians have no business holding any sort of governmental office.
Would Shaker and Quaker fall into it?
Yeah. Second model is that the church is superior to the state. This is the general Catholic outlook. It's a little different than when they ran everything. The holy activities of the church are more important than the earthly activities of the rest of society, and that includes the state. So whereas, you know, 1,000 years ago, the Pope could say the church is over the state, church is superior to the state, therefore I get to say who gets to be king. Due to history, the Catholic Church no longer gets to do that, but the Catholic theology still, and this is where you get the idea that priests are somehow holier, or monks are somehow holier than the rest of us. So that's, the Reformation was pretty rough on that. Third model is dual ministers of God. This is the Lutheran perspective. It splits human nature into the physical and the spiritual. The state has jurisdiction over the physical and the church over the spiritual. A lot of people love Jesus and hold this position. I disagree with it. So we're not going to talk about it a whole lot today. But it's where Luther's at, so, you know, you're not in terrible company. Fourth, and this is where I would sit, and I think probably the eldership, roughly. Government is a good gift, and this is kind of, I gave, you know, this away, 2 hours ago? That this is what I think. And this is the Reformed perspective. So roughly starting with Calvin onward. God's grace works through all aspects of human society, including government. And I could talk for a long time about this guy because he's a personal hero of mine. Abraham Kuyper, K-U-Y-P-E-R. He was a 19th century Dutch pastor, theologian, and prime minister, interestingly enough. Kuyper, K-U-Y-P-E-R. He's a Dutch Reformed pastor and theologian. He provides a great model of how to engage pluralistic culture with the gospel. I would love to talk more about him. I can't. We'll hit on two of his main ideas that I think are really helpful kind of conceptually for us today. One is the idea of common grace. So going back to the goodness of the created order, we see that God still upholds and preserves all that he has made outside of the renewal of the New Covenant Church. So just because sin corrupted everything doesn't mean that everything is worthless. So this would be kind of the Anabaptist idea. That's like the church is the good people, everyone else is the bad. Like there's no goodness outside the church. So, and we just know that not to be true. I mean, people make arts, people still build roads. I mean, common grace. Second idea is sphere sovereignty. Sphere, S-P-H-E-R-E, so sphere, globe. Sovereignty, which is spelled S-O-V-E-R-E-I-G-N-T-Y. It's not a word you see a lot, so. God has set up each life area of life to work in a certain way, and each area has its own kind of sovereignty or its own kind of inherent authority. so it doesn't impinge on others. So this is a kind of a complex idea, but essentially every area of life works a certain way, and even though, say, the church and the state, I would say, have authority over those other areas of life, they don't get to run them. So the church shouldn't impinge on the state shouldn't impinge on the church. Neither should, say, run the family. Say, a family is, you know, has its own integrity, has its own authority. I'll talk for a long time about that. All right, America. So by the time the U.S. was founded, the fundamental assumption in place was that the state should not run the church or vice versa. So no more Christendom. Though many of the founders were Christian, Christian morals mattered more than Christian obedience. So as I read history, by the time of the founding, most Americans were Christians. At least they held to a generally biblical worldview. But when we look at the writings of the founding fathers, they were very, very clear that they were not setting up a Christian society. They held to a generally Christian worldview. They all subscribed to what we could broadly call Judeo-Christian morality. But that morality, they just sort of assumed that that morality would underpin the populace and didn't have to be written into the form of government. Does that make sense? Is that a distinction that makes sense to everybody? So, yeah, Karen.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about what they were running from in England?
Yeah, and so we'll... we'll talk a little... When we get to this John Locke fellow in a second, we'll talk about that. So essentially, the American founding happened at a very interesting time. It was about 250 years after the Reformation. And so when the Reformation happened, there was... Essentially, Europe was ripped apart. So if you have a unified Christian society and you have, you know, guys like Luther and Calvin saying it shouldn't necessarily be that way anymore, you're going to have a lot of violence, and there was. So after between 50 and 100 years, Western culture was pretty much done with this. So there was the dominant philosophical mindset was that akin to what, you know, we think the church and state are separate spheres and they should be kept as separate as possible, even though both are inhabited by Christians. Does that make sense? So when we get to the Constitution, this is what we have baked in. The idea that they assumed a Christian society because that's what they knew. Fundamentally, most people were morally Christians, but they sought to set up the best government possible, assuming people weren't regenerate. Does that make sense? So if people are sinners, how can we set up the best government possible? And I think they did a pretty darn good job, but not perfect. Yeah, what's up?
Is that because at the time of establishing America, the king had actually kind of taken the place of the pope, and he was starting to dictate what was truth, and that's where we get like King James Bible, we get these different things that are happening.
The King James Bible was written in 1611, so I mean that was about 150. So I mean that was kind of like in the background, but by the time of the American founding, the English church and state, they were functionally actually pretty separate, even though still Anglican bishops still sit in the House of Lords. So, I mean, England's really, really weird. It's a functionally separate state with some trappings of church involved. But I would say that by the time of the founding, I mean, King George was, he was legitimately nuts, but... No, the church pretty much ran its own business at that point.
Gotcha.
But,
go
ahead.
Sorry. What about, like, early America in terms of
college? Right. This is where things are a little tricky. I would say that generally, we need to keep in mind that each colony was essentially a functionally Christian society, but different types of Christians. So the Constitution put together didn't want to, when we're trying to bring them together, we didn't want to say that we all have to be Puritans, because we can't do that. We have Catholics. And we had more than a few deists who essentially believed that God's super hands-off. The initial settlers of the North American continent, at least in New England, were pretty theologically competent and distinctive Puritans. So can't say they were all regenerate, because that's not a thing. But the Puritans had a very, very high... I would say they embodied just about as well as anyone this understanding of the church as a political institution. And so the church... I would say most Puritans had a very clear conception of what it meant to be, of what it meant to have Christ as Lord. But that was not necessarily the case in other colonies. So by the time you get to the founding, you couldn't assume that everyone had a fundamentally conservative high view of Scripture and that Jesus was Lord. Most of the founders, I would say maybe 50% of them would through their writings, articulate Christ as Lord. But the other half were really more interested in Christianity as a moral or system of virtue. Okay.
So they left England more so because they actually wanted political freedom.
Yeah, yeah. So at least the Puritans in New England. So we're going to keep going. So it's important to recognize that Christian values were always more popular than the Christian gospel. So even from the beginning. So once you get competing theological truth claims, you can kind of have like a basic Christian morality, but when you understand the gospel differently, you can't build a state on that. For two centuries, we as Christians felt like we were running things because broader cultural values reflected the Judeo-Christian inheritance. So when we talk of America as a Christian nation, its value structure was largely Christian for a very long time, largely biblical. Now we need to talk about John Locke, who was an English philosopher. No, he was Scottish. Sorry, Scottish philosopher in the early part of the 1700s, so say 50 to 70 years before the Declaration of Independence was written. His view of government was the dominant political philosophy of the day, hands down, and underpinned the political philosophy of the founders of the Constitution of the nation. Locke viewed government as unnatural, that it was a contract between free individuals in which they exchanged some of their freedom to establish a state so they would stop killing each other. So that was, Locke did not start with a view of politics and of government as fundamentally good and instituted by God. He viewed it as a part of the fallen created order to restrain anarchy and violence. And that was, I would argue, the founder's fundamental view of government as well. He made a distinction, and I think this is seen in the Constitution as well, between the inner and the outer person, and argued that government only had jurisdiction over the outer. So we say that, the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, that government should not institute a particular religious order, that there should be freedom of religion. And we'll talk about what that may or may not mean in a little bit, but that was fundamentally an inner disposition. So the government has, Constitution basically enshrines the idea that the government has no business saying what you should believe, full stop. But they can say, you need to pay this much in taxes, or this is how you do business. So they made a firm split between the inner and the outer person that I think is fundamentally incompatible with the biblical worldview. Moving along. Third point in John Locke. As a result, emphasis on a freedom of conscience is the basic liberal approach to religious matters. So when I say liberal there, I don't mean like the left, like we think of liberals now, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton. Liberal, like little l, classical liberalism was essentially the philosophy of John Locke, of the American founders, was that government, Thomas Jefferson put it best, the government that governs best governs least. That is, as near as I can put it, the classical liberal philosophy. So now we can talk about liberalism and the idea of a neutral public square. And here's where things get contemporary and a little sticky. Because of Locke and classical liberal separation of the inner and the outer person, we now have a situation where there is a perceived, quote, neutral public space. So when you go and make public arguments, it's kind of expected that you're going to use what's called value-free language. So if you are voting in Congress or you're trying to pass a law and you make biblically explicit arguments, that's going to be perceived to be just out of bounds, right? Does that make sense to everybody? You should use sort of, the idea is that you should use language that is accessible to everyone, that any argument has to be free or of value. Or the way we hear it a lot is that you, quote unquote, can't legislate morality. So that is kind of the trajectory where we ended up based on the starting little L liberal John Locke founder's view of kind of the separation of the inner and the outer person. Does that make sense? I mean, can everyone kind of see that and like how politics works now, the idea that you should essentially check your religious convictions at the door when you kind of step across the threshold in the public square? Okay. However, because God created us as whole beings, there is no way to separate the two. There is no such thing as a neutral public square. Every government, as we saw going literally all the way back, enshrines some sort of religious values. Like, you can't govern from a neutral place. So when people say Christianity doesn't belong in public arguments, that's just categorically false. You can't say that, because what they want to say is that our particular worldview, the humanistic, scientific religion of human autonomy, is the acceptable sort of language of public discourse. So, and that is, I would argue, the religion that is currently kind of underpinning most governmental activities. Right. No one's unbiased. Everyone worships something. So in church, when we talk, so like in a sermon, you know, Kurt will say, you know, idolatry. We talk about idolatry a lot here at Missio. Everyone has, if you don't worship Jesus, you're worshiping something, and that will influence how you live publicly. That's how God created us.
And people just make basic decisions that have consequences.
Yeah,
just,
you have.
Just baseline. Like, yeah. The decisions you make are going to have an impact on,
yep.
It's not as if nothing exists.
It's true. So, last statement on America before we kind of get to some of the more practical stuff, hopefully. Christian right and the left, I would say historically, have both been more interested in political power than gospel witness. That's not a political statement. I think, you know, if you're looking at, say, Christian liberals who have been really, really interested in, say, the poor, but tend to downplay the rights of the unborn. They're concerned with political power. They're concerned with getting their people in office. Same with, say, the religious right, the moral majority, etc. Both damage the church's witness. Again, if the church is not a this worldly political institution, but a next worldly political institution, when we are overly concerned with this worldly political power, we're essentially, we are abusing the witness of the gospel. Does that make sense? Does that, yeah.
We can't compromise certain beliefs, but like if you support one side, you're inherently compromising something else, and so you're saying that harms our weakness to like ignore.
Yeah, a good way to think about it is, let's go back to the idea of the keys. So if we as Christians say that all good Christians must accept this political position, then we are essentially saying that that is a prerequisite for church membership, right? So we are applying the power of the keys. So if we're saying that all Christians must believe this, and now I want to go ahead and this, we can play this out a little bit. I think there are political positions that because God is who he is, and we have the scriptures as our fundamental authority, that we must take, and there are political positions that we cannot take as Christians. But once you start stepping away from that, once you say, to be a good Christian, you have to believe in a strong defense. We have to spend as much on defense as possible. I mean, you can make a good argument for that, but you can't find that. I don't think that's a outworking of the gospel witness. And so once you say that all Christians have to believe that, then you are harming the gospel, because you're adding to the gospel, essentially. Does that make sense?
Or you're saying you can't be a Christian and a Democrat.
Yeah. And here's where things get sticky. Because when we don't just say it explicitly, but when the church's witness over a period of time makes it unclear where the identity of Christian ends and the identity of, say, Republican begins, then I would argue we have damaged the gospel witness. When the watching world can't tell the difference, then we're doing it wrong. So.
And we've done that. I mean, primarily you can tell by the language of our culture, Republicans and evangelicals are hand-in-hand statements. And unfortunately, we've damaged the gospel in that pursuit.
Yes. By conflating. So that's essentially a Christendom mindset, the idea that because we are Christians, we have some sort of privileged political stance, as opposed to saying the public sphere is where everyone can come and make religiously based arguments, but no one gets to dominate. All right, we're going to run through a couple of little things, and then we're going to do some discussion. Our fundamental political identity is that of King Jesus, and only secondarily to the United States. When we confuse that, that's when things get goofy. A helpful analogy is to think of the church as an embassy representing the kingdom of God, just like the U.S. embassy represents that nation wherever it is. We stand in for Christ in this age like an ambassador stands in for his country's government. This helps us think about religious tolerance. So the U.S. Embassy in France doesn't get to go shoot stuff up, right? So the church is an embassy of God's kingdom now. We don't get to exercise force. Can't prosecute false religions or worship. Can't separate the religious part of human life from the political. But we can revisit that if not everyone agrees with that. Some people may not. The church, not the state, gets to say what true doctrine is and who are true believers. I would also say this helps frame how we think about evangelism. Evangelism, I think it's helpful to think about, is a form of public engagement. So, you know, this will be my last kind of hard point. You guys can read the rest. We can go to town after this. The gospel of Jesus Christ is a public proclamation. It is inherently political. We are saying to a fallen world that Jesus is king, and you are in rebellion against him, and though he is graciously waiting to pass final judgment will be passed. I mean, that is a political statement. That is a statement of public truth. So when someone says to you, that's just what you believe, no, this is real reality. Christianity works for you. It makes you feel good. No, it does not make me feel good a lot of the time. It tells me that I am a bad person in rebellion against a holy God who someday is gonna make his wrath known. It's a public, so when we declare the gospel, we are making a public statement. Like, it has public consequences. Do you guys get that? Does that make sense? So this whole idea that Christianity is a personal, private thing is a load of crap. Like, that option is not open to us because of the gospel we proclaim. So, you guys can see my notes and some other things. I lied. I do want to hit one more point. Point nine. We can kind of, if you guys want to look over some of the other notes I gave you, we can talk about them. But you're right. So I left some blanks. I feel really bad now. All right. Our understanding of the kingdom of God that the kingdom of God has arrived, but has not yet been fully consummated as two political corollaries with a number of political outworkings, practical outworkings. First, we have hope that all is not lost. God is going to renew all things. Look to Romans 8. So we cannot be pessimists. Second, because God does not visibly reign over all yet, sin still reigns. And so Christians should recognize the limits of politics in the public realm. We cannot be utopians. And the next blank should be, if the local church is the primary locus of our political identity, or center of our political identity, and then we need a realignment of our political concerns from the local to the global. We should privilege local politics and action. And I think that's the last blank. So essentially what I want to argue there is that the way God built the church, it's a local expression of a universal reality, universal kingdom. So Missio Dei is a local expression of the universal church. And if we're going to understand our identity primarily, our political identity primarily in the church, and then work out from that, then we should be more concerned about political, like what affects our neighbors than what's happening across the world. Not that we shouldn't be disinterested, it's just we usually start with being most interested in what's happening at the national level and working down. I'm just arguing we should start from the local up. As a quick example, and then I swear we can just, I'll take any question you have. This is something I've been thinking about lately and it's been really convicting me, is the issue of the redefinition of marriage to include same-sex couples and of the sort of broader redefinition of human sexuality. We tend to think about it in terms of Supreme Court nominations, which are insanely important. I'm not downplaying that. Legislative activity, Congress, what the president says or does not say. And so when that is the focus of Christian political action, that's where we get, at least part of where evangelical Christians get the stereotype of being anti-gay, because so much of our public witness and public statement is nationally political. However, if we were to, while not ignoring national politics, be more concerned with how do we know and love and care for our gay neighbors? I think that if the Church of Jesus Christ was known primarily for how it loved its neighbors as a public political statement. Again, we can't get away, like, sharing the gospel is political. I think that would really, people would know us differently. So, for instance, are you guys familiar with the Supreme Court decision, no Obergefell v. Hodges? It's the decision that essentially enshrined the redefinition of marriage to include same-sex couples. I want to say 2014. The gentleman who brought that suit, Jim Obergefell, do you know where he lives? Now, I'm not saying that if he had, I don't know the man, never met him. I'm not saying he doesn't have confessing believers in his life. He may. But if we were more concerned with knowing homosexual partners who, and seeking to understand why they do what they do, why that gentleman would bring a lawsuit against the state of Ohio, rather than pouring millions of, or at least in addition to pouring millions of dollars into legal action, I mean, how different would the church's public witness be?
So. I think the individual cannot feel a sincere posture of love at only the state level.
Yes, absolutely.
But our engagement of the individual does not demand an absence of voice in the state level either.
Yes, absolutely. We are, as both citizens of the Kingdom of Christ and members of local churches in Cincinnati, but also citizens of the state of Ohio and of the United States, those are both meaningful identities, and those are ways in which we can and should live out the implications of gospel witness. We shouldn't privilege one over, I take it back, we should privilege what we do in the church over what we do in the state, but not to the exclusion of what we do in the public square. Okay, so that's most of my soapbox stuff. It's 11:30, it's supposed to run till noon. I promise you guys at least 15 minutes on presidential stuff, but I do want to make that the last thing. Any other, I don't know, what do you guys want to talk about?
Like Travis? That I have personally wrestled through, but yeah.
Sure.
And just say, like, well, our faith is not in the government, and the government's definition of marriage doesn't change our definition of marriage, and, like, how should that dictate how we interact with our
right. government? Okay, so if we start with, if we reject the inner-outer person distinction, that the gospel only applies to our inner personal life, but not to our outer public life, if we reject that, then we have to be concerned with, then we should want to see as much, we should want to see the law embody as much biblical virtue as possible. Not because we think we deserve to win or Christians are the best people, but God has graciously revealed to us what, how the best conditions for human flourishing, right? So we are not saying, like, we don't believe that homosexuals should be married because we dislike homosexuals, or we're terrified they're going to destroy our marriages, or they're icky. But because we believe that God has graciously ordained that humans work in a certain way, and that is that human sexuality. So it goes back to authority. Like, the authority, freedom does not exist in the absence of authority. That's anarchy. So human sexual freedom is not found in the absence of any sort of rules. Like, yeah, I mean, it's bounded. It's because humans are the way they are, and human sexuality is the way that it is, it finds its freest, fullest expression in heterosexual marriage.
So you would say if we advocate for that at a governmental level, mm-hmm. then we're ultimately advocating for people to have a better live amongst
yes.
God.
Yes. Yes.
So we're not just fighting for our beliefs. But
yeah,
we're
this is a necessary corollary of the idea that the gospel is a public statement. It's not just for us. We don't just think that heterosexual marriage is the ideal because it's what we just happen to think, or what our parents told us, or what happens to make us feel good. It is grounded in reality. Full stop.
So in a way, it's wanting the what God, like, that we designed, mm-hmm. in essence, to be like a common grace for those who don't believe what we're giving them.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely.
But it's not, I think, a good distinction that you made. We don't engage political realms mm-hmm. to make the world Christians.
Yes.
We engage political realms because we believe God's law, whether Christian or not, brings fullness of joy mm-hmm. in the good of others in this life now.
Right.
And if we yeah. love our neighbors,
right.
we truly will engage in political.
God already rules, including over the United States of America. And so we are telling people, stop rebelling. You are making yourselves miserable because you're in continual rebellion against God. Stop. Justin.
But it's... I guess I'm asking, like, where... There's somewhere that your outline has to be drawn, because mm-hmm. it's not that heterosexual marriage is preferred over homosexual marriage. Mm-hmm. It's that being a Christian is what is good and right for you. So, like...
Yes.
Like, there are some things that are infeasible to enforce
mm-hmm.
on a public
mm-hmm.
that is not Christian
mm-hmm.
that we need to enforce our own.
Yes.
So, like, do we put as much emphasis on, like, making divorce illegal or, like, things of that nature
mm-hmm.
where, like, we... hold that divorce is something that,
mm-hmm.
a marriage should be a covenant relationship, not
yes.
a man and a wife, but is Christ-centered.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you enforce a marriage that is not Christ-centered?
Sure.
Not
right. I want to be perfect, like, you can make, not every argument we make in the public sphere should necessarily be from Scripture. Like, because non-believers aren't necessarily going to recognize the authority of Scripture. So I believe that, again, because of common grace, there are good public arguments that we can make about why divorce is bad. Like, we can look at any number of sociological studies and say that, look, it clearly is a mess in a lot of lives. Not always, but, you know, the consistent witness is that this is not ideal. And we believe that because of scriptural revelation, but even for people who don't subscribe to that, we can argue that it's so for them. However, and this is where the idea of the two ages is really helpful, is that any state that is not primarily made up of people who subscribe to scriptural authority is going to be contested space. And so because we don't get the sword, we only get the keys, we cannot necessarily say that divorced people should go to prison. We don't get to do that because the laws of the state under which God has ordained that we live don't allow for that. And I mean, I would argue that divorced people shouldn't go to prison anyway, but so I would argue that so when, say, conservative Christians think that there's been a decline in public morality since the founding of the country, I would agree. Not because America is an inherently Christian nation, but because most of the people at the beginning understood that the broadly Christian worldview was the healthiest and was the best, like best promoted human flourishing. And so we can look back and we can lament that we have kind of declined from that, but we don't get to say that therefore God isn't in control or that we now get to grab the sword and make Christian values, you know, make everyone value them all over again.
What would you say to like a statement of, so I would say legislation tempers the heart of man, doesn't transform the heart of man.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Like if murder was legal today, you'd see a lot of people murdering people, right? So it tempers the heart of man, it doesn't transform it, mm-hmm. But also where that heart of man has been greatly tempered, is there more place for gospel reception in the midst of proclamation, or is there less? So are people more fooled that they're closer to God in a highly tempered society where if we mandated the absence of homosexuality and divorce and all these things, or in a more rebellious mm-hmm. society, is there more fertile ground? What would you say to that?
I know there are a lot of people who would argue that the gospel is more fertile in amongst, say, rebellious people. And I would disagree, actually. I would say that the gospel works equally on the heart of man under any scenario, and that aspects of submitting to Christ's rule appear more plausible in a, as you would say, more tempered, a society that's more tempered by Christian virtue and in a society that's not. If to use the parable of the prodigal son, so in a society of primarily older brothers, you know, good, virtuous people, the gospel still has things to say and changes hearts. And in a society of primarily younger brothers, of sexually autonomous people who do whatever the hell they want, the gospel still changes hearts. There are advantages to be gained under both sorts of view. I wouldn't privilege one or the other, personally.
So, I'm just sorting through it. So with the two different creations that are overlaying on it, mm-hmm. So, you know, when we are new beings, we honor the authority of the church, mm-hmm. And the old being is under the world stage, so in essence, we want to care more about making people become new beings uh-huh. and submit to yes. the church or, you know, God's authority. But it sounds like because of that view, we should not then be silent in the old world, but we should still voice
yes.
the what the Bible says, like what is mm-hmm.
that. Absolutely. So, so Christians are the only people who sit in this interesting space because we embody both ages, right? So, but we know that the old man is passing away and the new man is the what's going to live for eternity. So yes, in our public witness, the first and we can't hold heterosexual marriage on the same plane as submit to Christ. We have to privilege one over the other, but that doesn't preclude our public witness on matters of law and justice. Because, and again, we have, I would argue, the best resource for it because we have a true view of what man was created to be. And if public life is good and we are still God's stewards, then we, and common grace is still operational even in this age of corruption, then we can still make the best arguments for human flourishing.
Okay. publicly stating it doesn't mean it needs to be like law, like you said, like divorce doesn't make
exactly.
it punishable, but we can still say,
yes.
vocal, hey, divorce is not preferred, mm-hmm. and it's not mm-hmm. just Christians who believe
right.
it, who's the other reason.
And because we know that as long as sin is operational in the human heart, there can be no fundamentally biblical state. I mean, there just can't be. Like, we just... So you can't legislate all aspects of biblical morality, because even if you did, then you would just have, again, a society of self-righteous older brothers. That's not going to make God's kingdom come any sooner.
I mean, you've done a lot more reading on this than me. I've been wondering, because democracy is a pretty young form of government.
Sure.
But do you see it as, perhaps, you know, according to what we've seen throughout civilization and recorded history, do you see democracy as probably the best expression of government that provides for that context?
Repeat the question.
Sure.
I was asking if he, you know, according to what he's experienced and seen, if he thinks that democracy is the best expression for realizing the political aspirations of God's people.
Tentative yes. And I think that there are biblical resources for how to form a government. Not that the scriptural witness demands a certain form of government, but if we see that we are created in certain, like we are created in the image of God, and thus that means that we are certain types of beings. We're also fallen, so that means we are certain type of being. And so that there are forms of government that are thus better because they better reflect the type of being that we are. Okay, just that broadly. So I would say that from everything we've seen that is dysfunctional as it is, that not just democracy necessarily, because then it's just, I would say, gives human sinfulness full expression. Because we see that justice properly enforced requires institutional expression, right? So I think that representative democracy, one, honors the value of human freedom that we can establish because we are created in the image of God. God is ultimately free. We're dependently free, but we still are free beings because we're made in the image of God. But because, one, not everyone is qualified or capable of ruling. And second, because of human sinfulness, I think that it seems to me that representative government, in which we choose who gets to rule over us, is the best expression of human government we've come up with thus far. I'm not saying that there isn't anything potentially better. And that's why a lot of people are pretty down on the American form of government, and American democracy is, you know, a project in self-government. I still don't think we found anything better, to be perfectly frank. I mean, I think the Constitution is flawed because it embodies the inner-outer distinction that I think rejects the biblical picture of human beings as unified wholes. But it does the best of seeking to enable human freedom under put in place the right type of authority to enable human freedom. I still don't think we've done better. So, any other questions before we do the election? I promised I would.
Mm-hmm. But our political system has put it into two, you know, you get two choices, that's it. So mm-hmm. on one hand, you're maybe voting for someone who does not protect the rights of the unborn, mm-hmm. but is putting policies that are more for the less fortunate,
poverty.
So
sure.
I wonder, like, I'm a social worker, I'm all about
okay. yeah.
practical. Mm-hmm. So in this kind of system, how would the church guide people in mm-hmm. in saying, well, this is what's better, what's worse?
Absolutely. Okay.
Because I feel like either way you go, there are going to be things that are going to go against mm-hmm. what we
believe. Sure. I'm actually going to tackle that in just a second. Do you have something, Caitlin?
Because
that's right where I'm going.
Okay.
Yeah.
My question was, what do you say to people who, so it's like we're all here, so we're interested in some way, shape, or form in this topic, but
sure.
to people who are just completely disengaged or, mm-hmm. It's all downhill from here, I'm completely disengaging in any way, shape, mm-hmm. or form in kingdom civic duty or mm-hmm. even, my duty as a citizen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And,
right.
What?
Sure. Sure.
What's kind of the response?
I'm going to go ahead and those actually overlap. I'm going to break them down into three topics. First, I think our form of government best works when the church and the state aren't the only institutions, or at least when the state is not the most powerful institution. And what I mean by this is that this goes back to the idea of sphere sovereignty. So human life is much broader than what we do in the voting booth and what we do in the pew on a Sunday, right? Like, there's a lot more going on. And so when there are a variety of human institutions, of healthy, robust human institutions that recognize and enable those different forms of life, then there is a much healthier balance. So I think that, and this goes to the value of the local church, there should be we should see ourselves as not only Christians and citizens, but mothers, fathers, PTA members, teachers. I mean, the range of human identity is so vast. And that is where, and so I think a lot of people are cynical, especially a lot of Christians, because there's been this flattening of human identity to your religious, your political identity, and your economic identity, what you buy. And so I think that's one of the reasons why people are really cynical, because we've kind of lost other expressions of public life. And so what I would say to, that was a hobby horse, that wasn't strictly related, that was a little tangential, but people who have become, we can't be cynical, like I said, because we know where history is going. We know that there's no doubt. And we know that we're not purposeless meat machines. We are created in the image of a loving God, who created everything perfect. And the idea of common grace reflects the fact that there's still good in all of creation. So we can't be, I'm not even going to say we shouldn't be, a properly robust biblical worldview can't be cynical. You have to care what's going on. One, because it's still good, because God created it. And two, we know how it's going to end up. So we can vote with a sense of freedom that other people don't have. Like, if you're convinced that this is all there is, that this life, this election, then that's why everyone's freaking out. Because if you have no vision of human life beyond this present age, then everything has to be of ultimate importance. What we do now has to be of ultimate importance. But we know it's not. So does that make sense before we get to actual election stuff? Yeah.
When we look at the church here mm-hmm. in Missio, we know Kurt, Justin, the elders, perfect, do you think we hold a, with government officials, do you think we hold them a higher standard for government officials?
I'm going to fold that into my discussion of, because that bears directly on some of our current electoral problems. Carrie?
Sure. Sure.
I will tackle that directly because that's a little more big picture. Yes, we see in the Old Testament that, and this makes sense, right? Like nations whose governments more directly embody God's justice and righteousness are better governments, are healthier societies. And again, that's not because it's what we like better, it's the way God has wired the world. And so, I would say that most of those, so when Scripture talks about God's judgment of the nations, it does it in two separate ways. In the Old Testament, it is God actively judges unrighteous nations. However, I think in the New Testament era, God, I think Romans makes this pretty clear, God is forbearing active judgment. And so I think God in the Old Testament enacted physical judgment more directly and readily than he does in the age of the New Covenant. Not because he's not going to do it. He is holding off on, I would say, massive destruction of everyone on the scale of the flood so that as many as he has ordained will be saved. So I think that I am very, very hesitant to apply Old Testament passages about God's judgment on the nations to contemporary nations, including our own. But I think it is absolutely correct to say that God's passive judgment is absolutely in play. So I would differentiate the two. God's active judgment is fire and brimstone, boom. His passive judgment is that he's wired human beings to work in a certain way, and we violate that, there are consequences. And that is his passive judgment. So I would say that the United States, to the degree that it conforms to biblical morality, mitigates much of God's passive judgment. And to the degree that it forsakes how God has wired us, we incur God's passive judgment.
And I would say, too, that Old Testament, you had literal physical nation of Israel against pagan kingdoms. And then that's what got, what we're in now is still literal physical, but it's the nation of Israel in the circumcision of the heart and those who are God's people through faith in Jesus Christ. And then the pagan world and that the ultimate judgment will come. So I believe God's only going to judge those two nations.
Sure.
One will be found in the righteousness of Christ. One will be found under the eternal damnation of God forever. And so, like, Katrina wasn't God's punishment on America. Because I don't believe that God's really that interested to a measure on like, how righteous America is.
Yeah.
But as these two kingdoms that live in a reality of non-believers and believers.
Okay. All right. Any other? Okay. Our current quandary. Christians should care. I think I've established that we don't get the luxury of passivity. We don't get the comfort of cynicism, and we don't get to be utopian. So we should vote, It's not the most important thing you do. Voting will not make America God's nation. Okay? We're faced with a very unfortunate choice. I would like to say from the outset, I don't believe you have to vote for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And I'll get to that in a second. When we, to your point, evangelical Christians, biblically conservative Christians, have always, 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 always said that public servants should be held to a higher standard of common grace character. That's just the consistent witness of biblically faithful churches throughout the entire, throughout American history. And so I am fairly dismayed because in the 90s, I would say rightfully let Bill Clinton have both barrels for his abominable treatment of women. However, fast forward 20 years, and we have given many, I don't want to say, because I know many evangelical Christians aren't thrilled by Donald Trump's behavior, but a lot of self-proclaimed evangelical leaders have given him a pass. Not even just a pass, they have been actively apologizing for his behavior. Even going so far as to say that he is actually a Christian, he just doesn't know any better yet. So that would be James Dobson, the former president of Focus on the Family, said that he believes that Donald Trump is a, quote, baby Christian, and that we should not hold him to robust biblical standards of morality because he doesn't know any better yet. That is a, that harms the witness of the gospel in immeasurable ways. Now, there are a number of evangelical thinkers who denounce Donald Trump's behavior, which I think we can all agree is beyond reprehension. But pragmatically, they believe that he will primarily appoint Supreme Court justices who are more likely to interpret the law in ways consistent with biblical morality. Okay? Now, a number of them were, I don't think that that is a compelling argument for the following reasons. One, the Supreme Court, quick aside, soapbox, it's so, I think the American form of government is as good as it gets, and we are ruining it because it's not constitutionally robust anymore. So the president should have the most important thing a president does should not be the appointment of Supreme Court justices. The fact that that's where we're at is that is a statement of our failing of political life. The fact that that's how it is. But it is how, like, that is given how deadlocked Congress is, given how vast the, and almost self-sufficient the federal and state bureaucracies are, the most important thing, aside from sending troops abroad, that the president does is appoint Supreme Court justices. This is a fact. The most law is now made at the Supreme Court. Most laws of great import are for domestic policy are made at that level. Not all of them, so we should still be involved. Who you elect, you know, at every level, your representatives matter. But we are, I would say, in domestic matters, largely ruled by the judiciary. So the president's appointment of Supreme Court justices is very very, 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 endlessly very important. However, Supreme Court justices are going to rule for 40 years, max. America is going to last for a, who knows? I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not like that guy. And yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
I'm just trying to summarize. Yeah.
Yep.
So some people, I guess, can negate his actions by saying, well, let, there are people on there who are godly who will put in legislation that I agree with. I don't agree with him.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so that is that, yes, there are, yes. That's not persuasive for me, for one, because I think that to... Even if we denounce his character and his behavior, but still as a, I mean, most pollsters saying about 80% of self-professed evangelicals are still going to support him. And my concern, I am concerned about who ends up on the Supreme Court. I am more concerned about the character of gospel witness in this nation. And if 80% of self-professed evangelicals think that Donald Trump has the, at least implicitly, because the vote isn't just a pragmatic state. You are implicitly saying that this person is at least morally qualified to do this job, because public servant is a moral job. I think the damage to gospel witness is going to be vast, and that's what concerns me most. Now, let's move on to Hillary Clinton. If you guys have to go, I'll take a question at the end, but go ahead.
I was going to just have an official dismiss since it's after 12, but then
yes.
People want to...
Yeah.
But do you want to ask your question first real quick?
I've got some more to say, and then I'll wrap it up, and then we can dialogue. But I'll stay as long as you guys want. Recognize you got to go. If you have to leave right now, I'm not voting for either of them, for Clinton or Trump. If you have to go, that's where I'm at. And I'm going to continue telling you why. Okay, Hillary Clinton is, I have severe reservations about her moral character as well. Not nearly as many as Donald Trump's. I think she is technically qualified in ways that Donald Trump is not, to understand the ins and outs of a fairly complex federal government and world affairs. That said, I cannot vote for her because she unabashedly supports the right of women to abort a pregnancy at any, as near as I understand, at any point in the pregnancy. She joyfully celebrates the redefinition of human sexuality, gender, and marriage in, I think, profoundly unbiblical and destructive ways. And I am immensely concerned about the people she would put on the Supreme Court. That said, she's probably going to win. So that doesn't mean I'm voting for her either. So I do not believe that the vote is a fundamentally pragmatic action for these reasons. So when people say that if you vote for one, you are implicitly voting for the other, that is a utilitarian argument, okay? And it subscribes to what I would call the consequentialist fallacy. So utilitarians, thanks for coming. Essentially, the ends justify the means to promote the most good for the most people with the least amount of pain. So that is the utilitarian mindset. And so when evangelical Christians say they're going to vote for Donald Trump, they make a pragmatic utilitarian argument that I loathe everything about the man, but he is more likely to support Supreme Court justices that would uphold biblical morality. people who I would, Christians who say they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. She holds a very low regard for, I would, core value, core biblical moral values, but she's more quote-unquote qualified. To say that the vote is a primarily pragmatic thing, one, I think discounts God's sovereignty. So when we say that we have no idea what's going to happen, he could wipe America out on November 7th, and that'll be that. But to say that we are somehow going to forestall further moral degradation in America by voting for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, I think belies a lack of trust in the sovereignty of God to care for his people and for all people. And second, the vote has always been understood as an implicitly, it's a moral act. It's always been understood as that. It's been understood as a responsibility granted to a free people under the authority of their duly elected government. Those are not just political statements, those are moral statements, okay? So we should not necessarily hold public figures to the same level of accountability that we would hold church elders, but at the same time, we are placing them in positions of moral authority, and to vote for them at least implicitly underscores that they have the requisite moral character.